Tape 3 of the conversation, Mr. James Foreman. Proceed.
Oh, my heavens, we've got a demonstration.
I see you on fire. It's not far from here. I mean, the South African mission. I might probably have to leave by 4:15 or 4:20.
What about the role of the, quote, white liberal, who James Baldwin says is an affliction? The role in the Negro movement. Has he a role? Has he a place besides being an affliction?
Well, what do you mean by white liberal? How would you define it?
Well, I'd have to ask James Baldwin what he meant.
Yeah, but well, then I think that, you know.
A white man, then.
Well, now there are white men and then there are white men. Well, I don't know if that's my responsibility. But, you know, I think that there are whites who work within SNCC who play a very important role, who are respected, and there's no quarrel that one can have with. On the other hand, I think that there are certain whites, on the other hand, who are prepared to support your movement from afar, who are prepared to wish you well. And then on the other hand, when sometimes the going gets rough, then, you know, he's ready to pull back, or if you move in and around his neighborhood, you know, he's not prepared to accept that. And let me just say that here again, lacking a definition, and a definition publicly and also one privately of what a white liberal is, then I really just can't make too many comments because I don't understand what the term is.
You couldn't find a vaguer term, clearly. But the well-meaning fellow traveling friend, I guess you would say.
Well, whatever that means.
Whatever that means. Malcolm X says that even the white man who goes to jail was just doing it for his own reasons.
Well, I think that all of us are doing it for our own reasons, fundamentally. I mean, you know, everybody, we ought to know enough about psychology to recognize that people have varying personal reasons for doing certain things. And many times, that's irrelevant, you know. It's what's the social effect of what a person is doing that's important.
Let's go back to the private school, public school business a moment, and the question of defending the best opportunity for one's child as one position, sometimes opposing the same man's heart to his interest in public education. Back to Mr. Galamson, his case, agreed not to criticize. Suppose you have the man who's opposed to the long-range busing on the same grounds. This man might be the Negro or white.
Well, you know, people...
Same problem arises, doesn't it?
Yeah, people are entitled to their opinions. The whole question is will their opinions become the majority opinions?
Well, we can leave it at that. That's always the case. Who wins?
Yeah, that's right.
If it's on the question of power, as who wins, then we wipe out the question of ethical consideration, don't we?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily at all. I mean, I would grant to the segregationists the right to believe in segregation, but at the same time, he has to recognize certain ethical questions. And certainly others must recognize this. And I don't think that and maybe it was very flippant to say, you know, it's a question of who wins, and I wouldn't. And I must say that that's not just a position, who wins, you know, because I think that there are moral considerations, there are ethical considerations that enter into all decisions, in a sense. And it's not just a question of who has the most might, who has the most power, and who can then pushed down or thrown to somebody else's own position.
The point I was pushing at is this. If we grant that the Reverend Galamison, who believes in the public school system, fights for it, at the same time puts his child or children in a private school, he's carrying on two obligations at the same time that don't happen to match. Except point to point. Now, the parent, white or Negro, who objects to the busing because it's bad for my child. You see, I believe in the public school system, but this is bad for my child. I'm defending my child's best interest in opposing the busing. Yet I believe in integration. That's parallel to Mr. Galamison, isn't it? Ethically parallel, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so, and I'm not much of a philosopher, but it seems to me that you have two considerations. I mean, the act of putting one's child in a private school is a voluntary act. A person is agreeing to pay for it. On the other hand, involving the child in a public school, you know, then you're subjecting the child. You're not subjecting, but the whole concept is that in terms of the public school facilities, then that integration is a desirable thing, and I don't think that the two are ethically the same in a sense.
Well, integration, we'll say, is desirable.
But in addition to that, though, but you see, I'm not sure of the relevance of all of this. I really am not. I mean,
it becomes relevant if a man is taking a position on the question.
In other words,
if he has a child, and which side is he on? Or say on the busing problem, where's the knife edge fall? He may be for integration, but everything has a cost. He says, this is too much for more than I'm going to pay at an hour on the bus or two, or whatever the time is on the bus. He might say it that way. I'm putting two goods in competing here now. I elect my child's good, or what he considers to be his child's good. I was saying the problem exists as an intellectual and moral question, which can be debated on high terms and not bad guys and good guys terms.
Well, very well the case, and I haven't thought about it. As a matter of fact, I haven't given too much consideration to the whole problem of integration of schools in the North, in a sense. See, because I think that fundamentally that all of these measures are simply stopgap measures.
Let's agree on that.
You know, they're basically stopgap measures, and that we really have to, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do it because it's a way of forming opinions. But I think that there are more fundamental things wrong with the society that have to be corrected before these things can
happen. Like getting better schools.
Like eliminating other structures of segregation, like trying to wipe out certain myths, certain ideas, like getting rid of all those Southern Dixiecrats down there who helped to perpetuate these myths and so forth.
After you had, let's assume something, civil rights, bill with teeth in it, effective, fair employment practice codes effectively administered, or decent housing codes effectively administered, integration of schools, say, then what? What problem lies beyond that?
No, you haven't mentioned,
problem.
You haven't mentioned the whole question of voting. See, because none of these things...
Let's add voting. I meant to include that. Let's add voting.
All right, we're going to establish the principle of one man, one vote.
All right. And they got all those things in the bag. Then what? Anything remain to be done?
All right, let's state them again. We got one man, one vote.
One man, one vote. Integration of schools and public accommodations, fair employment practice and general civil rights. Are these things in force? With good intentions and fair efficiency.
Mm.
Then what? What remains?
Well,
as a racial question.
Well, I hope that would be the end. I don't know what would come up. But it seems to me that you know, then either before that or concurrent with that, one must begin to work at some of these other fundamental causes of poverty and the whole question of reform within the society. I'm not sure that You will see, I'm not sure, and maybe this is where I'm pessimistic, that you're not going to have some type of militant action to watch over people's opinions. Now, wait just a moment. I think that if you had these things, you see, that then you would have the basis of addressing, you could address yourself to more fundamental problems in the society. And then maybe that would be an absence, in a sense, of racial segregation. The skepticism obviously grows out of my own experience that people might, while you have that, you're going to have a lot of perhaps infractions of that kind of a situation, but maybe ultimately, and we're speaking now obviously in terms of 100 to 150 years, you know, because I don't think all this is going to come in my lifetime, you know, just don't, or my children's lifetime. I don't have any kids, but so that you would have obviously the outward removal of these things, and what you would have to guard against is the subjective opinions of people creeping out and again expressing racial attitudes. You see what I mean?
Yes, you're militant supervision of opinions. That's the phrase you use.
That's right. So that they then, so that this opinion does not creep into opinion does not then form some sort of movement contrary to what is right and is the public will.
This is a little off the point, but it crosses my mind. What do you think about leaving Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn unexpurgated on the public school shelves?
Never read it. I don't know if it's a good book or not. But a lot of authorities have said it's a very good book, so that I'd have to reserve judgment till I read it.
Would I ask Dr. King, the question phrased differently, the same thing about the phases of the Negro question, you see. The third phase being after the civil rights and such have been put on the books. He said it corresponds to the third phase of the Gandhian program. He said, to paraphrase, Operation Bootstrap for the Negro to raise standards.
Well, I would be in fundamental disagreement with an Operation Bootstraps among Negroes at this level, in that I would think that what you would have to do, that the Operation Bootstrap would have to come as sort of government-sponsored programs, in a sense. In other words, I don't think that Negroes ought to even try to assume the responsibility of going around here saying that in Mississippi we're going to teach every Negro to read and write. That's a governmental function, and the government's the only person capable
of
carrying it out.
All right, but raising standards is not only a matter of...
But what does it mean then? Well, what do you mean by raising standards? What are you talking about?
Well, I think it's what applies to all society. The willingness to say we are going to change the level of performance within this town, this state, this race, this community.
Yeah, but you see, here again, and this is... this is exactly what I'm talking about in terms of watching opinion, you know, because if you had this third phase and then you say, okay, now the Negro has got to raise himself up to be accepted in the society or so that he can be like the other white people, then by definition, you still have an opinion that regards him as something different.
The de facto inferiorities exist in certain whites and certain Negroes.
Well,
they have been underprivileged and they are simply inferior performers because they have been lacking motivation, lacking training.
That's right. Okay, so that it seems to me that it's a question of who is going to do the Operation Bootstrap, you know. I mean, is the society going to take a public posture and say, okay, you know, we're going to have these crash programs as we've had in Appalachia? Are we going to say that we're going to go into Mississippi, the government's going to have crash programs to wipe out literacy, or is it then going to be that we will all become urban leagues, you know, and it's up to the Negro to do that. That, I think, is relevant, and I don't think that you can evade it. And at the point, not only is that relevant, but it then becomes a whole question of raising the levels of the society also.
The point there that Dr. King, I'm driving a shoe, would not preclude any kind of governmental action and governmental subsidy. He would not say, don't do that. He was emphasizing the fact of the will of the Negro as a minority to change its level, not to have it done for it, but to participate in the doing.
Yeah, well, obviously the people, the government can't do anything for people that people are not prepared to do for itself. But I think maybe we ought to understand some of the background out of which I speak. I mean, I'm in Mississippi now, and I'm dealing with people, or we're dealing with people who are illiterate.
Yes.
People are saying, well, you know, if the Negro would scrub his face, if he'd wear clothes, if he'd comb his hair, maybe if he would use 2 bottles a month, maybe if he would learn to read and write, then maybe he would be acceptable to the American white society, you know.
Yes,
and I say that the whole problem of literacy in the state of Mississippi is not the fundamental problem of SNCC or any other civil rights organization, that this is a problem to which the entire society has to dress itself and is only capable of doing it because of the resources, you see. And, I mean, obviously the people are going to respond. They're responding now to the little classes that we're holding, you see. But let's not revert back to what I think is sometimes Booker T. Washington philosophy. Let's pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, because it can't be done. It just cannot be done.
Well, there are ways and ways of helping oneself. Your organization is one way.
Of course, of course. And you know, I hope we hurry up and go out of business. You know, I really do. But at the same time, I think that we have to recognize that a lot of the problems, we might have a Fair Employment Practice Act, but then we may not have any jobs, both for Negroes or whites.
Which raises something else.
You know, which raises another question. And that question is, I'm not trying to defer all types of planning, but I don't know what these hypothetical situations really signify, because there are a lot of variables. I mean, one, we all may be destroyed in terms of thermonuclear war.
That's something else.
If we can hold everything constant, you know, which, you know, obviously cannot happen in this world, then I think that we could really address ourselves to that question. But maybe I'm just not given certain answers before I can see that the answers are really relevant in a sense. And I don't see where that kind of an analysis is now relevant.
It's relevant in this sense. It indicates differences in basic attitudes among people. For instance, talking about a speech by Dr. King, Wyatt Walker said, this sort of speech, Mr. Walker would make to all Negro gatherings, but not to a place where you had the white press. You see? Operation Bootstrap, or the self-help, self-improvement sort of line, which could be said, that's Booker T. Washington all over again. We don't say that in certain communities, certain groups. But it should be said behind the closed door, as it were. The Negro college, the Negro school, the all-Negro audience. This is a one point of view about that whole question of the obligation, an attitude, not the capacity. But clearly, a minority group is not going to have the resources to do a crash program for itself, but an attitude toward its own responsibility toward the program.
Yeah, but the question now, you know, is who does the program? You see, I think that's your moral judgment also.
Yeah, it's a question I'm raising anyway.
Yeah, well, okay. But at the same time, see, my position is that, you know, if I've answered this hypothetical problem.
Yes.
In that I feel that at that stage, then, you know, the Negro should, his resources should be involved in doing this, people, you see, As a matter of fact, I mean, I think it should, you know, we should begin to do more and more of this as of now. I don't think that we ought to just wait, you know, until we've reached this millennium.
Because the phases
are not that separate.
Really.
That's right. That's exact. That's again. That's very true. And not only are they simultaneous, but that even now, it's a basic responsibility of this government to institute some of these programs. I mean, we ought to be eliminating poverty not only in Appalachia, but in the Delta of Mississippi. We ought to eliminate illiteracy in that state. We shouldn't wait until you think the Negroes have the right to vote because, you know, there's, you know, a lot of simultaneous relationships, as we both indicated.
What do you understand by freedom now?
What are we getting?
Slogan?
I presume you read Theodore White's article, who is very apologetic about it, as I understand.
Which article?
In Life magazine or something, where he criticizes freedom now.
No, I haven't read it.
Oh, I see. Well, I think that, as far as I'm concerned, freedom now is a slogan. And it's a slogan that is used in terms of motivating people to come out of their apathetic positions, to grapple with the whole questions of fear, and to recognize that social change is possible. It's quite obvious that there cannot be, you know, any kind of universal freedom now for any man, you know. I mean, because if we want to get philosophically, one, where does one's freedom begin? You know, the freedom is limited the minute that the mother puts a diaper on the baby, you know. But I think that it is an appropriate slogan, and a slogan that has challenged the imagination of the Negro and has presented to the American public a spirit, a driving force, which is characteristic of the Negro movement. The term freedom now actually developed in Africa, and it had extreme relevance for the people in Ghana in that it meant the end of colonialism and the beginning of a new independent nation. Gradually, we began to adopt a slogan in the United States, just as the whole slogan, one man, one vote, had its roots in Africa, and we're beginning more and more to use it in this country. But I think both slogans are extremely relevant. I don't know if I've answered your question as to what freedom now means to me, but it's basically a slogan used as a motivational device. That's right.
Now, there are some people who confuse the motivational, poetic quality of the slogan with the practical objective.
Well, you know.
People do.
Well, that's right. People differ.
What about the relation of the Negro middle class to the Negro movement? How do you read that?
Well, the Negro middle
class. I'm generalized about that. I'm afraid
I'm sorry.
Well,
you know, whatever the Negro middle class is, and however we define it, we have to define it as a caste society within a class structure. You see, and that it's affected by racial discrimination. On the other hand, you know, if there are any basic disagreements with the Negro middle class, it's a disagreement with all of middle class American life in the sense that, you know, better life for yourself, better life for your kids. The whole question of people suffering is not necessarily relevant to your existence. I think that what is often postulated as the middle Negro class or the middle class Negro is in many instances not really middle class in the traditional terms. I think that there are, you know, a lot of Negroes who are fairly well off, but I think that the Negro middle class, you know, hampers a lot of racial progress, you know.
You said it earlier. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, it does.
But it doesn't feel itself committed.
It feels itself.
The Negro movement.
Yeah, it feels itself committed to certain advantages for that class. For instance, in Atlanta, you know, you got a lot of good middle-class Negro homes.
I've
been
out to
Crestwood Heights, Collier Heights, you know. But at the same time, there's no mass movement on these people to do something for the poor Negro in Buttermilk Bottom, you know.
Has there been an increase of identification between the Negro middle class and the Negro masses, or a decrease in recent years, or can you estimate that?
Well, I think that the struggle has, you know, forced sort of greater cooperation. I don't think that there's been any decrease, but I don't think that the increase has been such that we need to, you know, wave banners and shout for joy, you know.
One theory is that there's been actually, while theoretically an increase of communication and of feeling, there's been a de facto decrease because of the split between the prosperity of the Negro middle class and the depressed mass has become greater. There's been actually a widening gulf between, say, the depressed Mississippi Negro and the depressed Harlem Negro and the prosperous middle class. Economically, it's become wider. That's one theory.
Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, I guess that could statistically be proven. I just don't have to.
They claim that it can be.
Okay, but even if that, even the fact that that might could be statistically proven does not necessarily mitigate the fact that many middle-class individuals may have become aware of their social responsibilities. And so from that point, that there can be a closer alliance. As a matter of fact, I think that what the student movement or protest movement in this country has done has raised questions to the middle class and I guess to the leaders or the rulers of the country, in a sense, the whole question of poverty. There's been a dialogue is being created. I mean, I think that the whole question of the Appalachian program would not have become very significant if there had not been students that went into the Appalachians and began to relate these things and then began to pressure the administration. And I think we have to do more of this.
But the Appalachian thing is really a backlash from the Negro movement.
Well, I'm not. I don't want to claim all
of that.
I think it's relevant. Yeah, I think so. I really do.
I should think so too. I guess it is.
But a lot of people have been working down there.
In a mass movement, there was a number of people in positions of leadership. There's bound to be, it seems to me, some overreaching in the struggle for control. I don't mean a struggle necessarily for mere powerlessness, but policy. This means more and more promises made, more and more, you see, appeals of different sorts made. Have you seen in the present movement this process leading toward driving toward a centralization of power? Classically, it winds up with one man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Classically, it winds up with one man.
That won't be
you don't case. See that as a possibility.
No, because I think that what's happening is that there's more and more decentralization. I think that ACT is an example of decentralization of policy making within the Negro movement. I think that SNCC is another example of decentralization of policy making. Even SCLC is a form of decentralization of policy making, and to some extent CORE. And if there's one organization that one could say that this is spreading away from, it would be the NAACP, which over the years has been sort of the one organization that was involved in making policy relative to the Negro. And you've seen a mushrooming of organizations and protest movements in the last 7 or 8 years.
You remember,
and that's good.
You remember Mr. Wilkins' remark at Alexandria?
Yeah, what about that? We do the work and pay the bills, and the other organizations make the noise and get the credit. Well, he's wrong. You know.
Wrong how?
Well, you know, if that's what he said, I mean, then it's not true, you know, because there's some of us who would feel that we're doing a little work, but we're certainly not doing much work.
He didn't say no work. He said, we pick up the chips. We tab the bill when it's over. We're the continuing organization.
Yeah, well, that's not true either. I mean, you know, and he knows that that's not true.
He would say it was true at the time.
Well, it wasn't true at the time. And he knows that.
There are so many questions I'd like to get at, and I'm feeling nervous in the last few seconds, you know, now. James Baldwin says that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern majority.
I think he's right.
You do?
I think the Southern mob is a reflection of the Southern politician and the Southern power structure, the police. See, I think that the real culprits in the South are not the so-called poor whites that people sometimes like to castigate, but basically those politicians who control opinion and who decide policy in given situations, you know. I mean, in their economic counterparts.
Do you happen to think, to agree with the theory that the two hung juries in the Beckwith trial were rigged, was a drama, arranged beforehand? This is a view, it's in print, you see, and it's held by a certain number of people in Mississippi. It's put into the sheet passed out by an ACP friend.
Well,
Mr. Everson didn't believe it, but he said he
entertained it. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, it very well may have been in that, you know, but I don't know. I question.
It takes a lot of doing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I question.
It takes a lot of doing.
What I think that happened was that the people who clearly knew that Beckwith was a killer, and then there were some that didn't want to convict him.
If that's the case, that trial is historically very important then.
It is. No, I think that the climate of Southern opinion is changing. No, I don't think there's any question about that. I was acquitted in a case in Alabama.
Where was this now?
It's in Fort Payne, Alabama, right up in the northeast section, you know.
What's the date of this case?
Oh, it was a year ago, the time of Freedom Walkers.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Very important.
Yes. Well, Alabama's much more mixed than Mississippi anyway.
Yeah.
Much more dissent.
That's right. That's true. And, of course, both Wallace and Mississippi are trying to suppress all sorts of dissent. You know?
Yes. Well, you're a free man now. Let's knock it off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope I helped you.
You have a lot.
Thanks a lot.
End of interview.